Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, a Star Trek podcast by two guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Benjamin R. Harrison.
Ben, it's hours after we recorded the episode for Gambit Part 1. You, having just seen Gambit Part 2.
It's fresh in my memory.
We're finally on the same level.
It feels good to finally be on your level, Adam.
Get on my level, Ben.
Oh, having a little pod fluid, are we?
Yeah, I figured that may have been the problem that we thought we were having in Gambit Part 1.
Oh, not burpy like, enough?
Were we having awkward pod? I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, maybe we were just in a bad mood or something.
I'm feeling great right now. How about you?
I'm feeling good.
Yeah?
You know, excited, nervous. Got the big tour coming up, talking Greatest Gen Con stuff, and that's, you know, there's nothing more exciting or nervous-making than the idea of throwing a big event like that.
Yeah, I thought big events were in the past for me.
Yeah.
You have a wedding, and that's over. But this is like a nerd wedding.
It's like a nerd wedding. It's so different, but so similar. And You know, like the joke with weddings is that if they find out it's a wedding, all the prices get multiplied or whatever.
And right.
We have been working on a way to do Greatest Gen Con that makes it so that it doesn't have to be a way too expensive type of deal.
That is the tension in the system. Like, every argument I have about Greatest Gen Con is about what can we do to lower the price?
Right. And the real killer app of that is that we have a friend with a space now. So we can defray a lot of the like, huh, what's this? Like the there's margin built into the question of what do you want to do again?
Right, exactly.
And So things are looking good for it, but we're still, you know, there's still lots of details that need to be hammered out, and it is like, I mean, like we talked a few months ago about how the Greatest Generation is kind of a one day a week job for the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
Starting to feel like more than that.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, for the past few months, I haven't had a lot of video work, and I don't know if it's like this for you, but I either get a lot of video work all at once, or I will go 6 weeks with relatively little to do.
Yeah.
And now it's like July into August is going to be, I'm going to be totally slammed with both tour and con and actual real work. So I'm going to be so ready to go out on tour is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of it is that, like, when you have free time, as I have as well lately,
it's really easy to just kind of like fill a day with like, oh, now I'll check the Facebook group and now I'll work on that edit. Now I'll like try to come up with a merch item. Now I will email somebody about a sponsorship, you know, like it's one of those things where I can kind of always think of something to do with relationship to Greatest Gen, but also like maybe I'm being a little excessive.
I don't think so. I mean, this is the sort of project where it always feels like something could be done at any given moment. Man, this might be like getting too dark or deep for you, but like I don't feel like I have had a successful day in a very long time, because like the way I define success in many ways is like getting it all done. Yeah. And there's just too much to do to get all of it done.
Yeah, I mean, Greatest Gen is not that. It's more of a, I mean, it's like,
right. I mean, I get the satisfaction of finishing an edit just like you do. And that feels like those little wins along the way really help. But these longer term projects like tours and the con are something else entirely.
Yeah. And I think we've both, you know, gotten used to careers where our projects are relatively lots shorter than what we're doing now. like planning a tour several months in advance. Like knowing what I'm going to be doing 3 months from now is a totally alien experience to me, you know?
Yeah, the rewards are far different, too. I mean, I've never completed a video project that felt as good as a crowd laughing at a dick joke.
I know. Yeah, it feels really
good.
And
I really love video projects, so.
Yeah.
That says a lot.
It does. It feels a little bit like wrenching on an engine or something to draw a comparison to something I know nothing about. Like to some extent, making the show feels like maintenance, where I can kind of just walk around and like tighten a bolt here and check the oil there, and like, and it kind of runs itself. But there's also
this is tinkering.
Yeah. There's always tinkering to be done.
Zen and the Art of Podcast Maintenance.
Let's write a best-selling self-help book, Adam. That's our next project.
You know, like, there's been the proliferation of podcasts and podcast people, but one thing I haven't seen in, you know, whenever a new thing gets zeitgeisty, there's always the person that builds a career around consulting about that thing.
Yeah.
You don't see a lot of that in the podcast space, I don't think. Or am I just not seeing it? Like,
There's definitely a few companies that are like, we will, you know, take a $300,000 retainer to make a podcast for your sinister banking organization or whatever.
Well, at the expense of giving away $300,000 in consultancy fees, I'll just say this. If you're interested in doing a podcast, get a couple of mics and find a buddy and make your show, because it's about the greatest thing ever.
It is. I was thinking about what makes our show work, and I think that one of the things that's most important to me about it is just getting to belly laugh at shit you say all the time. Like, if you have a friend that you can't stop laughing when you're around them, and by some stroke of luck, the same is true in the other direction, like, you've got something magical there, and you can bottle it so other people can enjoy it.
I feel the same way, and, like, the thing with what has been bottled for this show that is strange is that we are not proximal friends. We are long-distance friends.
Yeah.
And so I wonder how much of that is critical to the success of our show. Like, if you and I were hanging out all the time, drinking porch beers and shooting the shit, like, I'm not sure if the show would work as well as it does, because this is our porch.
It's possible, but we've also had, like, extended hangs now, like, you know, on our tour last year, and we went to Max FunCon, and, I mean,
best friends with your parents-in-law?
Yeah. I feel like that hasn't, I don't think that that's diminished the show. It's just given us more in jokes to say out loud on the air that nobody but us will understand.
So true.
Well, Adam, I feel like we've beat around the bush quite a bit in this fairly useless Marin Open. Do you want to...
Yeah, well, you never go pod on pod, do we?
Yeah, we. I mean...
Fairly masturbatory.
Perhaps we don't do it because it's too masturbatory, too self-referential, not interesting or funny enough. So
unlike the episode we're about to watch, Ben.
Yeah.
All of those things in spades. It's season 7, episode 5, almost a fifth of the way through the last season. It's Gambit, part 2.
This is becoming a speech.
You're the captain, sir. You're entitled.
Not entitled to ramble on about something everyone knows.
Never give me the fraction, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, what I've done is invited 30 emails. actually... I'll tell you where you can take that correction. 206-984-4FUN.
Oh, poor Brian Fernandez. Sonny D's going to have to screen a lot of math correction phone calls. I feel so, like the gambit that the eponymous gambit in this 2-episode arc is this Riker and Picard kind of wordlessly playing at let's get in a firefight, Data, like play along. And Data plays along.
So much of the deep behind enemy linesness of this episode is just communicated with glances. There's a little bit of like Picard and Riker in a condo on the ship, you know, talking about real shit and how they're going to conduct themselves going forward. But so much communication is happening non-verbally in a pretty fun way. Like there's code breaking on both sides.
I totally agree. It's fun to see Data like, this... is subtle, but I think it's real character development for him that he is able to catch what they're throwing at him.
It's the sort of thing that you only get with a crew that's been together for a long time. Like, you could not expect Jellicoe to grok this.
I don't like you.
Yeah, Jellicoe's the guy that you, like, bring onto the improv team, but he hasn't played with you guys before, so he doesn't really know, like, who to pimp and... you know, what strengths to play to in the different members of the group.
Jellicoe's weapons are always on 100%.
Yeah. So they do the thing where they make it look good.
Release inertial dampers and cut power to decks 31 through 37.
Aye, sir.
Set phasers to 25%.
They squirt out a bunch of ketchup to make it look like they've been hit.
Yeah. And... Galen, a.k.a. Captain Picard, is explaining that, like, doing all this shooting is taking a toll on the mercenary ship as well. Because they've had, like, some engine problems and stuff. So he's saying, like, maybe we should just bug out right now and not push the ship too hard. Like, we've scored a hit against the flagship of the fucking Federation in our little dinky tick. Let's get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, get out while they're ahead, right?
Yeah, and the Romulan lady agrees. She's like, if we remain here, we will be destroyed. And so Captain Baran is like, all right, well, let's get out. Like, they didn't get all the relics that they came to steal, but he's willing to, you know, bug out and fight another day.
I think
bug out appropriate because their ship looks like a tick.
I think this marks something of a streak for Baran, who has at every turn offered up a course of action and then been rebuked by his crew with a better idea. Like, I can't think of an idea that Baran has had where everyone's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Let's do it. All his ideas are wrong.
He's only captain.
All he's got is the shock collars.
Yeah, and that's been discussed. I think even in last episode, Picard... is saying to the Romulan lady, the shock collar is the only thing keeping him in power. He is the power grows from the barrel of a gun Maoist captain of this ship. And, you know, maybe in some ways, like a thing that this episode arc explores is that a good leadership style? And I think fairly compellingly comes down on the side of no.
Yeah, you're not gonna find Baran's leadership book in an airport bookstore.
The Art of the Steel by Arctus J. Baran.
How to win friends and influence people using shock collars.
Yeah, Baran later in his career got in big trouble for defrauding a lot of students of his Baran University. Turned out to just be a big scam.
Baran's pretty hip to the idea that he's not very well liked.
Yeah.
And so he's like, he like sort of grooms Riker. He's like, look, man, this Galen guy has been a problem for a long time. I think he might be stirring up some mutinous vibes.
What's so the deal? Picard was like doing he was like on vacation doing some archaeology when he got kidnapped by these guys?
That's just it. That beginning is so thin. He is valuable enough to have a Secret Service detail around him at all times, right?
Yeah, it's
captain of the flagship.
It's kind of nuts that Baran and everybody else is not aware of who Captain Picard is. It seems like if you're going to be running some pirate shit in Federation space, you should know about like who might be hunting you.
There's no vacation you can go on where you don't bring an ID, right?
Yeah, does he have his dog tags up his butt or something?
I don't know.
He did another fucking vacation with no comm badge, didn't he?
He really likes to go off the grid.
It's not a smart move.
No, and it's not like wherever he goes to do archaeology, he's taking a shuttlecraft, right?
Right.
Like, how does he not have Federation materiel anywhere around him?
Yeah, you would think that he would have even a runabout or something. Doesn't he have a captain's yacht? Where's his yacht?
Yeah, we never see that yacht getting used.
But all that is to say, Baran is not at all aware of what Picard's bona fides are, but he does think that Riker is this kind of like disaffected Starfleet guy. And so he thinks that Riker can be useful for doing shit that is Starfleet related. But also, like, he says to Riker, like, Galen, a.k.a. Picard, hates your guts, but maybe, like, get to be friends with him, because if there's a mutiny, he's going to be on Team Mutiny. I want to know who else is on Team Mutiny. You find that out, and then once you've found that out and we finish our mission, I want you to kill him.
This is information that Riker is happy to share with Picard as Galen later on, when Picard as Galen tells Riker, you should get close to Baran. Figure out what makes that guy tick, and see if we can't, between the two of us, figure out how to usurp his leadership.
And Riker's like, wait a second, am I on Team Baran, or am I on Team Picard, or am I like secretly on Team Picard?
And throughout the episode, they're punching each other in the face. Like, that's fun.
Yeah,
like they have to really enjoy that as characters.
They spend a lot of time beating the shit out of each other for Baran's benefit.
Yeah.
It's good times.
They never talk about it.
Yeah, do they? Is Riker pulling his punch and Picard just selling the shit out of it?
Yeah, I mean.
And then, like, later they go, like, that was a nice one. Like, I think you really bought that. Or are they really punching each other?
Neither of their faces look like they've been hit in a way that is credible. Like, there's no nose bleeding, there's no cut across the cheek.
Right. I mean, that's hard. It's hard to know whether that's just, you know, TV canon or that they are, in fact, pulling their punches. Because as we discussed in the episode where I talked about my former roommate who stole art and got beat up for it, your face stays really fucked up for a long time if you get punched really hard.
There are varying degrees of severity when it comes to getting punched in the face.
Yeah, I got punched in the nose one time and it didn't really damage me much, but it did break my glasses. Maybe my glasses took most of the force.
God, getting punched in the face wearing glasses seems so dangerous.
Yeah, I didn't even have time to say, you wouldn't punch a guy wearing glasses, would you?
Did you wear them home?
I cannot see at all without my glasses. I am very, very nearsighted.
Oh, no.
So,
were you the actor who had to wear glasses on stage?
What do you mean?
Tell me an acting story, Ben.
No. I didn't get a prescription until I was in high school, which was well after the majority of my school play career was over.
Mm, I see.
I mean, I wore them in college when I was taking that acting class, but
I didn't like glasses when Brad Pitt wore them either.
Fuck you.
I was just going to see how long you kept that ball in the air before snatching it.
The other crew that is having tension is the crew of the Entrepreneur. Worf is not super pumped about the way Data is running the investigation. And is like, Worf is champing at the bit, you know? Like, he wants to fucking ride out and cut some heads off. He wants to hit some dudes in the chest with batliths.
He's sort of feeling the Riker vengeance vibes.
Yeah, if Data had gotten abducted in the next round of hijinks and Worf got left in charge, like, the ship would be at full war mode right now. You know, they would be like...
It would be just indiscriminately shooting torpedoes all over the place.
Yeah, separate the saucer section, we're fucking killing everybody.
I'd kind of like to see that episode.
The episode where Worf gets just totally unhinged and goes on a vengeance quest.
The episode where we run out of torpedoes.
What they realize is that there was some data hidden in a carrier wave that Riker used when they had their little phaser battle in space. I guess they had Riker try to use his command codes to take over the Entrepreneur, but the command codes had been changed, which is like the first time maybe in the history of the show I've heard of the Federation having a good security policy.
Yeah, good job.
I've worked for a couple of media companies, Adam, and when I stopped working at one of them, all of the passwords to everything changed. And it wasn't that I was like trying to get back into the system, but like there was some like employee thing that I had to fill out, and I like couldn't even get back into their HR thing to do it because all of the passwords changed. I've worked for other media companies that have no such policy, and it's like, oh, I can still fucking administer your Facebook page that millions of people go to? Like, guys.
Yeah, ridiculous.
Not smart. This is a good policy. Change the command codes when somebody is out of pocket. And so they find that the command code thing was in fact a gambit.
Oh, that's why they call it that.
To conceal some coordinates for another planet. So Worf is pumped because they have a, you know, an actionable clue, and they know that they can beat the bad guys to the planet. The second Data agrees to pursue this clue, Worf is fairly gleeful.
Finally.
That they're not sitting around doing science the way Data wants to anymore. This precipitates a pretty intense showdown in the ready room where Data kind of has a talking to, like a pretty on point talking to with Worf, that like Worf is being like fairly disrespectful of his authority and fairly blatantly in front of the rest of the crew.
I think part of it is that under their breath to Worf means something totally different to most other people. Like Worf basically does a full volume, Jesus Christ, finally. Like in full view of everyone.
Yeah.
This is the scene I was talking about before. This is the scene that I ruined in part one of this podcast, which was like the different ways that you can be a first officer for someone. Like the argument that your job involves covering for the captain, providing alternatives for the captain, and doing so in a way that maintains like decorum and the chain of command is a thing that I know Worf understands.
Sure.
But his way of doing that is just very different from how Data did it. And from, after talking to Data, how Riker does it.
And Worf really realizes how off he's been. I think that it's such an interesting scene because Worf is justifiably pissed off. He's probably embarrassed that he let Riker get grabbed. And he just really wants to get the problem solved as fast as he can. And I think Data is looking around the bridge and he's going, there's a bunch of yellow shirts on this bridge. This is not feeling right to most people. So
yeah,
we've got to like kind of manage, like we got to make them feel like this is okay. Like cooler heads are prevailing here.
Right. This is like Secretary of State as president. Like how fucked up does it look on the bridge? to see command fall to the third in line. You've got to be even more rigid in how you treat people and situations at that point.
It is a really interesting position for Data to be in. And this is the scene that explores it. And I think this scene is really well written.
Agreed.
I like that when Worf, you know, Worf is leaving and Data, like, as an aside, says, like,
I am sorry if I have ended our friendship.
And Worf turns around and says, no, like,
it is I who has jeopardized our friendship, not you.
It's big of them to call attention to it and move past it. I think so often in the work environment that we frequent, you just don't work with that person again if you can help it. Like, you don't crew them anymore.
Yeah.
And in that way, like,
I am very familiar with that choice.
Like, the stakes are higher there because you don't have the conversation. You just don't get a phone call.
Right.
And this is a better way to address that. But great scene.
Great scene. Captain Picard is doing his little, he's like running around the ship trying to convince people about a mutiny plan. The guy that invented the hacky sack, I think his name is Narek, is like, yeah, like mutiny's a great idea, but
they're not going to follow you.
And Picard's like, oh, really? Who will we be following? And he says, well, my money is on T'Lara. And smash cut to Picard alone in his science room, and T'Lara, the Romulan, comes in with a dustbuster, and she is, she's like, I've got you dead to rights. You're not who you claim to be. I want to know who you are and what you're doing here. She found the secret message.
Picard is in a pinch, and the only thing Picard can do is cop to it.
Yeah, there's no other way to play this.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess he could have blamed it on Riker and let Riker get fragged, but that'd be a dick move.
Yeah. That's what you do if you want to live, though. I think his chances are diminished by making his admission. But by making his admission, T'Lara also admits her truth, which is that
he pulls down his pants, and then she turns around and pulls down hers.
She's like, yeah, I'm not T'Lara at all. I'm T'Pol. And I'm on this hunt.
Are there any female Vulcans not named T'Pol?
Yeah.
What the hell is going on with that?
Yeah, very common name. I love that T'Lara tells Picard that her name is T'Pol, and then Picard calls her T'Lara, like, in the very next breath. Did you notice that?
I did not notice that. So they have this conversation, and she is Vulcan intelligence, and she is tracking a group of Vulcan separatist extremists who have hired Baran to get all these artifacts. And what they're trying to do is assemble this thing called the Stone of Gaul, which is a terrifying Vulcan weapon that works on the principle of psionic resonance, and it can do bad things. It's like a super weapon.
And that's what Picard's been scanning all that pottery for.
And so she's basically counting on Picard. Like, they're like, all right, eye to eye. Like, we're both on the same side. We're both undercover in this thing. Let's fucking make sure that these maniacs on planet Vulcan don't get this terrifying weapon. Because if they do, it's back to the bad old days. Like, they are trying to isolate Vulcan from the rest of the world, and they're willing to be violent to do it.
It is a guiding principle on which Starfleet is based. Have you can't find it within yourself to stand up, tell the truth, you don't deserve to wear that uniform.
Okay, so they have one piece of this item, and they need three total to put it together to complete the puzzle to make the weapon.
Right.
Enter from stage right a Klingon on a shuttlecraft.
A Klingon on a very distinctly non-Klingon-looking shuttlecraft, too.
It looks like a 1920s elevator car. Like, I want to know everything about the shuttlecraft.
He stole it from Willy Wonka?
Yeah, it looks great. It is piloted by the 6'9" James Worthy.
You play basketball for the Los Angeles Lakers.
This is what I want Klingons to look like. I want them to be way bigger than everybody else.
Agreed. It's and really shot for scale too. The way they shoot him, they make him look 9 feet tall.
Yeah, he's always like 3 feet further in the foreground than everybody else, so he looks extra big. They also do some great like over the shoulder while he's still on the ramp to Dr. Crusher. So you know he's like essentially up on an apple box talking down to her, and really towers over her.
It's great. Like the one thing you want if you're using a non-professional actor is to give them a minimum amount of dialogue, and that's what they've done here for mm-hmm. James Worthy.
They've given him a Patrick Warburton amount of dialogue, I would say.
Yeah, that's right.
You're not going to read anything on the on the flight?
No.
Perfect Warburton. That's a real nice P-war there, Ben.
They've used a provision in the Klingon Federation treaty that allows them to take his ship on board the Entrepreneur to do a health and safety inspection. And amidst that, they are tossing his ship looking for relics because they know that that's what Baran is after. They don't on the Entrepreneur have any clue as to what's going on with the Vulcans. Like they're just trying to figure out how they can get Riker and Picard back. So the Entrepreneur crew is, you know, tossing this ship. Data and Troy take the Klingon guy up to the observation lounge to like entertain him while this search is taking place. And that is when a mercenary crew led by Riker beams into the shuttle bay, and Picard runs into the shuttle and is like, "Relic's not here. We gotta go find the Klingon. He must have it on his body." They beam up to the observation lounge. They find the relic on the Klingon.
And then to ensure their escape, Picard calls Riker on his shit, and he's like, "You haven't had our back the whole time. I'm going to end this right here." And Picard shoots Riker in the observation lounge and then beams away with the boarding party.
Yeah,
it's pretty badass.
Isn't there some shit where, like, this is where Riker is going to theoretically kill Galen?
Yeah.
Too?
I love how Riker apologizes for shooting Worf and Beverly on the shuttle bay for that, but that front zip that takes one to the dome, like, as soon as they beam on, gets no such apology.
No.
Like, he is dispatched immediately.
Super disposable.
And dispassionately.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fuck that guy.
Yeah, so Riker stays stunned on the ship, and Picard and the other aliens, they've got the guy that invented Hacky Sack and two kind of randos. They all beam back to the mercenary ship, and the game is afoot, because now they've like mostly assembled this terrifying weapon.
I feel like many, many times in this two-parter, they have the choice to follow the ship, and they're like, "Let him go. We'll figure this out from here."
Yeah, well, they've got Riker, so he's going to know what's up, right?
A Riker that they know to be alive, but that the Raiders believe is dead.
Yeah, which is great news. Like, that's a great little edge that they've got. And the other edge they've got is that the Entrepreneur is at full warp capacity, while the bad guys have a greatly limited top speed.
Yeah, they kind of have a jalopy.
Yeah.
They're always having engine problems.
Their bridge looks really good, but the ship don't work so good. I think Baran just isn't on a good maintenance schedule, you know? Like, he just drives right past that 10,000-mile oil change and does not take it into the dealer for a servicing.
You know, you're not going to get 100,000 light years driving your starship like that.
No. You know, it's just about building it into your monthly budget. You got to assume that you're going to have some maintenance costs with any starship.
I read that this was a battle bridge redress.
No way.
I hate that they redressed the battle bridge because it means the battle bridge probably isn't coming back.
Hmm.
I love that battle bridge.
Yeah, battle bridge.
I love the
good.
Battle bridge because navigation and con are in the most reclined positions. They're like basically lay flat beds.
Lean back.
Yeah.
That actually, there's something in the show Bible that that lists the sets that they like keep built, and then there's like other sets that they can build or rebuild, but they, you know, like cost money. So they.
Oh, Ben, can we do a little mid-episode Bible study?
It's good to see you all in church.
It's called the Bible.
That's the way God wants it. I don't know why, dude.
All these questions? Is a little blind faith too much to ask?
Oh, here. How interesting. Note, this is not a standing set and costs money to reconstruct. In extreme emergency situations, the saucer section of the Entrepreneur detaches from the warp drive section of the ship in order to seek safety, enabling the captain and minimum crew to face the danger. Control of the warp section is maintained from the battle bridge, a much smaller auxiliary bridge as compared to the main bridge. Like the main bridge, there's a captain's ready room adjacent to the battle bridge. Who knew? I don't think we ever see that secondary ready room.
I don't think so either. That would have been fun. No money in the budget. It's all across the street.
Yeah.
We're using it as a blindfold for the bust of Gene Roddenberry.
Mm-hmm. They get back to this bridge, and Galen, a.k.a. Picard, is ripshit about the fact that Riker betrayed them over there. And he says he suspects that it was Baran's idea, and this is the mutiny scene.
I have something else for you, Baran.
And Baran is like, well, I'm going to have to zap you then, because I can't have you mutinying in the middle of this important mission. And he very dramatically presses the button, and not Picard, but Baran succumbs to the pain ray.
Picard totally Snoop Dogged him, because when you try to zap Picard, you zap yourself. No?
Another way of putting it, Adam, is that Baran got schismed.
We're really supposed to believe that Baran allowed his belt buckle to be taken and reprogrammed so that it would zap him instead of anyone else? It's a pretty big leap.
Why would Baran even have the fucking implant?
That's ridiculous.
Don't get the implant if you don't want to accidentally zap yourself, Baran.
If you can't take the implant heat, get out of the implant kitchen.
Don't do the implant crime if you can't do the implant time.
Don't fake the funk on a nasty implant.
Sure, one of those will stick.
They're all staying, Ben.
My love is a fever.
So they're heading to Vulcan, and Picard slash Galen is now in nominal command of the mercenary ship. And that's kind of a surprise. Like, Talera was the one that had the crew's faith when she wasn't in command, but Picard is a compelling leader. Like, he gives orders with utter self-confidence, and they really just fall in line.
He captains not like Galen, but like Picard. I would argue that he is Picard as captain of the ship.
Totally.
Like, he acts exactly the same and commands the same amount of respect because of it.
It's funny because his character, like, he is definitely playing a role as Galen. He is not.
Right.
He is not acting the way Picard would act. And that is for Baran's benefit. But the second Baran is gone, all of that artifice falls away.
Yeah.
And his, you know, the natural leadership that he never let the rest of the crew see just comes in full effect, and they're, like, completely helpless in the face of it.
Maintain our present course and speed for now.
I'm going to find out when and where we're supposed to deliver our cargo.
Aye, Captain.
So they're heading off to planet Vulcan, and Riker gets on FaceTime with Vulcan security, and he's like, hey, guys, I have some bad news. The bad mercenaries that you've been tracking are on their way to Vulcan. The good news is that your secret agent, T'Pol, I'll let you do the math on which lady that is, because apparently all women on your planet are named T'Pol. But your secret agent that you have on the mercenary ship is you know, keeping track of the situation. She's there with them. It's all good. And the guy's like, well, see, that's just the thing. While there are millions and millions of Vulcan women named T'Pol, we don't have anybody stationed on any mercenary ships undercover.
The administration it would take to figure that out. I can't imagine. Yeah, like, could I have the last four of T'Pol's Soch to confirm this?
And then on the mercenary ship, Picard is like, he's putting all these little pieces together. He's got the two relics, and he's like, this relic is really weird because it's got the Vulcan god of death and... what's the other one? God of... Yeah, the god of war and the god of death, but there's like a very obvious place where there's another piece that's missing, and I wonder what goes there. Like, can you shed some light on this, given that you've been on this case for so long? You must know what's going on.
T'Pol's like, it's probably nothing. No bigs.
Yeah. Well, like, Picard plays this very well, but he's got her dead to rights, right? Like, right in this moment?
Yeah, because she, at this point, has been as transparent as one could hope her to be when you're in, like, a group of thieves. Like, she seems to be somewhat credible up to this point, but the moment she becomes unwilling to share what knowledge she clearly has, that's when she becomes untrustworthy.
Well, it's not just that. If these are pieces of a very dangerous weapon, let's replicate some fakes and take those down. Mm. You know? Like,
oh, good thinking.
What the fuck are we doing assembling this? You know, why are we carrying water for these terrorists if what this ultimately builds is something that we'll have no control over?
Yeah, these guys are really bad mercenaries.
They pull up to Planet Vulcan and they beam down to this like secret cave that had some significance in the last civil war on Planet Vulcan from way back in the day when the Vulcans were a warlike people. And T'Pol's got the other pieces. There's no other Vulcans there, right?
No, it's just a box full of cash.
Yeah, she pays the mercenaries, but it's substantially less than they were expecting. W/R/T remuneration for all their trouble.
It's just all die packs.
I like
it. Spin this.
The thing that we talk about with heists is that, like, the more of your guys die, the better for you. And a lot of the guys have died, so they should be like, well, it's less than we expected, but each of our share is worth more.
Yeah.
So at least there's that, right?
Yeah, but when there's a box full of cash, you need at least one bill to cover the die packs. And this is when it's all die packs, there's nothing to spend. I wish I knew someone who worked at a bank. I want to know more about that stuff.
The secret die pack stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, they must train you to do the die pack, right?
Yeah.
They don't keep that thing...
Yeah, and it's in so many movies.
They don't keep that thing armed, sitting around, right? Like, you must have to do something to it when you're putting it into the money bag.
I don't know. That's why I thought, you know, in so many heist movies, they say leave the bottom half of the pinch of bills you're going to take out of the till.
No bills off the bottom of the drawer, please.
That would seem to indicate to me that the die pack is always armed.
It's just
in
there.
You don't want to move it or jostle it or take it out of the thing.
Hmm.
Maybe removing it from the till arms it.
Whoa. I think the only way we're really going to be able to get to the bottom of this, Adam, is if we rob a bank.
I'm prepared to do that.
It'll be a tax write-off because it'll be research.
It's one of those things where the conclusion forgives all of the crimes that led up to it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So this is like the guy that invented Hacky Sack and the lady that looks like a bad guy in Double Dragon down here in the cave with them. And they're like,
nuh-uh, like, we're not letting you take your little relic without giving us the full amount that we agreed to. And T'Pol is like, all right, well, now that this is assembled, let me show you what the downside of being ungrateful for your small amount of money is. And she aims this thing at them, and this, like, blob of, like, Miss Buttersworth syrup comes out and hits the guy that invented the hacky sack, and it, like, tosses him, like, 30 feet back. Like, it goes from being, like, one of the worst digital effects to one of the most violent wire effects you've ever seen.
These guys really get kicked.
Yeah. Like,
and I think the first guy actually, like, there's a piece of rockery in the back. He sort of rolls over on top of it.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of a compound stunt.
That can't have been fun.
No. Yeah. No, there's no way that feels good at any point.
It's the slowest weapon of all time, though, right?
It kind of is.
It's like, just fucking step out of the way. It's like, it takes, like, four Mississippi before it actually hits you.
It also, like, the defense for it is the Ghostbusters 2 defense. Like think happy thoughts. Get in that Statue of Liberty and walk around a while. And the most unlikely outcome is the idea that Worf would have enough happy thoughts to keep this thing from killing him. Because this thing, I guess, feeds on, amplifies, and redirects violent and negative thoughts towards the victim.
Yeah.
And so by being super chill, Picard is able to shrug off its effects. Riker's able to shrug it off. And so
obviously, Riker just thinks about fucking for a second.
That's what I was thinking. Like, what if on Riker, it just sort of coalesces around his groin and just starts hammering that groin?
And you just...
like, speed bagging it?
Just... ECU of his face as his eyes cross and his, and he catches a little smile on his face, like the time he got the suck disc rig put on.
Worf is like, I'll have what he's having.
I am the cutest of all. There are four lights.
T'Pol just keeps trying, though. She's grabbing this thing harder. She's crossing her eyes. It's not having any effect.
Yeah, and Picard, who is still calling her T'Lara at this point, is like, don't you realize, like, the reason this thing doesn't work is because it became useless when Vulcans went to the peace plan. Like, if it only works on people who are violent, and if you have logic and you're peaceful at heart, it's not useful anymore, and that's why it was disassembled.
Yeah, so why don't you try being nice for a change?
It turned out she was one of the bad guys all along, Adam.
That was the big reveal, wasn't it? Yeah. So whatever happens to her, do you think?
I don't know. Her move when she realizes that this is not gonna fly as an attack is so, like, bad guy in Scooby-Doo. She literally clenches a fist and goes, "Doh!"
Yeah. The parenthetical in the script is axe defeated.
Disappointed!
I don't understand her plan. Like, was she supposed to be chief baddie if she was able to get this weapon to work? Was she actually going to sell it?
Were there actually other separatists that were part of her plan, or was she like a solo actor?
That's just it. I don't know if we can believe any of that. I think she was the solo actor. I think she brought everyone down to the planet surface to kill them.
She was either the solo actor or the budget was too tight to hire a bunch of other people to play Vulcans that were part of the plan.
That's fair. Because if you have Vulcan budget, you want to make sure you spend it all on that one Vulcan from Star Trek 3 and 4.
Yeah.
Instead of like four or five anonymous Vulcans.
Right. So the button on the episode is there's kind of a walk and talk in the hallway with Picard, Data, and Riker, and they're kind of summing up all of the exposition of how the episode is being wound down. The
bad guys are in custody. The artifact is being taken apart again. There's like lots of historical value to it, but
it belongs in a museum.
First thing is to check it into, you know, the weapons locker at the precinct. And Picard is like, all right, well, I'm gonna take care of some personal shit and then I'll catch you guys on the bridge. And Data's like, well, and then and Riker's like, technically you're not actually in command of the ship right now, Captain. Captain Picard is like, well, you actually have a point, but if we're being truthful, neither are you.
Are either of them wearing the neck thing in this scene, or have they already been removed?
I think they're... Let me look.
Yeah, I was just going to pull that
removed.
Up, too.
Yeah, Picard still has his Renfair costume on, but they don't have any neck pips.
You never know when you're going to want to wear that again. You probably throw that in the back of the closet.
Yeah.
You're just a ball gag away from a complete uniform.
Yeah, if he meets another astrophysics officer that he wants to bang, he's got some kinky shit that he can get into with him.
Yeah. God, how great do you think that shower is for Picard after all this? You're wearing all that leather. That leather doesn't breathe.
There's nothing that feels better than a shower when you know that Riker is being taken to the brig by your humorless android second in command.
So satisfying. Speaking of satisfaction, Ben, were you satisfied with this episode?
I was. I think it's a much better episode than the first part. And I liked the first part pretty good. So, yeah, I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, in totality, it's pretty good.
I think that maybe the biggest knock against it is that the villain winds up being a little dumb. Like, she should have had a plan for, and I don't know how to solve for this, right? Like, how do you have the artifact mostly assembled on the mercenary ship and convince Picard that the thing to do is to take that stuff down to the planet's surface and reunite it with the other part of the artifact?
Yeah, there's a math to that scene that I don't think they got right. There's a way to make that work that in its current state, it doesn't hang.
Yeah, like maybe you replicate a fake, but then you do a switcheroo with the real piece.
Yeah. Yeah, and it doesn't take more than another bit or two of dialogue. You don't need to add cast to this to make that work.
Yeah, but if that hadn't popped into my head while I was watching it, I think it would have been a pretty solid episode all the way through.
Yeah, I think mostly the thing that I like the best about these two episodes are the characters acting against type. Like, it's sort of meta acting. It's an actor acting as a character who's trying to act like something else. And that's very satisfying when in the hands of such good actors.
Indeed.
Ben, one thing that would satisfy me greatly is to read a couple of P1s. Do we have any of those?
I assure you that we have P1s.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental.
Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Adam, we have two priority one messages here. The first one is from Matt and the ragged remnants of humanity hiding in the West Virginia hills in late 2019. And it is to Adam and Ben in mid-2017. Oh no! We have another message from the future.
Please give us advice.
It goes like this. If you're reading this, there's still hope. Ben, Adam, it's about Raz and Plevim. They're you. You from the Mirror Universe. The gross one with bare arms Picard and the goatee Spock. Their P1s are really coded messages to their minions giving orders for launching a doomsday plot that begins at your upcoming live... Oh, Jesus. They found us. Beware the... And the message is cut off.
Oh, no.
That is chilling news, Adam.
Well, the thing about messages from time travelers, Ben, is that, I mean, it doesn't help to change course, because what if by changing course we run into the same problem?
Yeah.
I'm fairly convinced that whatever is going to happen will happen.
So you're a Calvinist.
I swear I'm not. Ben, our second priority message is from J-Mac. It is for D-Helps. Goes like this. Is life getting you down? Does it have you wearing a frown? Do you feel like the gravy train has left you behind? Don't worry about a thing. I've got the cure for all your blues. Just perform the JL Pipes maneuver and have a great birthday.
Oh, that is a little bit of a belated birthday. It says here the goal was around June 11th, but hopefully that belated birthday is no less heartfelt.
Hang in there, D-Helps. There's no reason for those blues. Just grab the bottom of your shirt and yank over and over. That'll get you through this.
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Well, if you'd like to wish somebody a happy birthday or warn them about a trans-dimensional plot to destroy everything, you can go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron, where a personal message is $100 and a commercial message is $200. And those things are a great way to support the show.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible.
Drunk Shimoda!
I did. We've talked a bunch about Data's very evident advancement in his understanding of social situations in this episode. The fact that he picked up on the subterfuge that Riker and Picard were engaging with. But one thing we have not talked about is the fact that he cracks a joke. And not just any joke, kind of a dad joke. when Riker takes the phaser blast and the rest, and you know, Galen and the rest of the hair metal band beam off the ship, they've got Riker on the floor and somebody says he's only stunned, and Data's response is, I am experiencing a similar sensation. Zing.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, that's pretty great.
How about yourself?
My Shimoda is going to Corral, the James Worthy Klingon, who has a great scene in the observation lounge. Data's like, you know, while we're killing time here, maybe you would like to sample some of our blood wine, Klingon. I believe you may enjoy this very much.
Our beef sandwich, Philadelphia.
Yeah. And Corral takes his chalice of wine, holds it out from his body, and slowly overturns it, dumping it onto the floor. And they didn't show the carpet, which was probably a good idea, because that carpet be expensive.
Yeah.
But I wonder what was actually happening under the table, if he was just pouring those into a bucket or not.
Yeah, I was picturing
some behind
like
the shot.
I was picturing one of those gray TSA bins with like a towel folded up in it.
Yeah.
But
yeah, because you don't want the splash out to stain the carpet either.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That chalice that he had there looked unmistakably like one of the ones from the reception in Starship Mine.
Yeah, that was full of yogurt raisins.
Yeah.
You know, that's something in Starfleet, like, they just have a warehouse full of those and they outfit ships and stations with them.
Yeah,
pretty
I love when
issue.
You see that shit. The television show The Good Wife is shot, like, two blocks from where my apartment is, and I guess now they're shooting The Good Fight over there, but, every so often you'll walk by and like the doors on the sound stages will be all up and you'll see the backside of all the sets. And one time I was walking my dog past there and I walked past what I guess was the properties department.
Mm-hmm.
And the garage door was up and the shelving system most near to it had just like every vase that they use on the show.
Cool.
And I loved I wanted to snap a phone pic and then like watch the show and like play bingo with all of the like 30 vases that I saw that day. Thought it would have been fun.
There was an auction in Portland after the show Grimm went off the air.
Mm.
And it was in like a Boeing sized hangar. And the auction wasn't for film gear. It was for housewares and lights and lampposts and mailboxes and knives and, like, you could probably outfit several homes with what they were selling at this auction. It's sort of, it's the thing you don't really think about when you're staffing up a show, doing locations for a show. That art direction stuff, you gotta house it somewhere, and there's a lot of it.
I had a shoot last year where I did a bunch of videos about barbecuing, and at the end of it, we had like a ton of nice kitchen stuff and two barbecues and like you know, all this like patio crap that was like nice stuff that, you know, you would like, oh, like I don't want to quite spend that much for myself kind of stuff. And I got direction from the executive producer, like, get rid of this stuff, I don't really care what happens to it, but we're not storing it. So
nice.
And so, like, I got to give a friend of mine like a $200 barbecue.
Excellent.
Yeah.
That feels good.
I love it when shit works out like that. Yarmouk and Jalad at
Tanagra. When I was growing up, I didn't have anyone to tell me about personal grooming. I had to learn these things on my own. So I'm here to save you some embarrassment and recommend the grooming tools that I use, the products from Manscaped. Now, this is a company that constantly has its mind on your bush. Imagine the meetings they have. Imagine the pictures they have in their PowerPoint presentations. Now imagine your junk looking its best thanks to the Lawnmower 5.0. This thing is the latest Bonch trimming technology. With two interchangeable heads, a standard one for taking just a little off the top, and a new foil blade to go smooth wherever your heart desires. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants.
Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. Every mom I have ever given an Aura frame to has absolutely loved it. And that includes a lot of moms I know. This is a gift that I have personally given many, many times. And it's great. I can upload photos from my phone the moment I take them. And that means that mom or grandma out there is going to get pictures of their loved ones delivered to their living room. And right now, Aura is having a great sale for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com and use the code SCARVES at checkout to show your support for our show. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, when you listen to podcasts, it really just comes down to whether or not you like the sound of everyone's voices. My voice is one of the sounds you'll hear on the podcast Dr. Game Show, and this is the voice of co-host and fearless leader Joe Firestone.
This is a podcast where we play games submitted by listeners, and we play them with callers over Zoom we've never spoken to in our lives. So that is basically the concept of the show. Pretty chill.
So take it or leave it, bucko. And here's what some of the listeners have to say.
It's funny, wholesome, and it never fails to make me smile.
I just started listening and I'm already binging it. I haven't laughed this hard in ages. I wish I'd discovered it sooner.
You can find Dr. Game Show on MaximumFun.org.
Video games can make you laugh.
They can make you cry.
They can even make you sing.
We're the hosts of Triple Click.
It's a podcast about video games.
This is an exciting time for new games, from Diablo to Final Fantasy.
From Starfield to Street Fighter.
From Zelda to, oh, who are we kidding? We're just going to talk about Zelda.
Whether you play games or you just like hearing about them, we've got you covered.
Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye.
Ben, what do we have coming up on the next episode?
The next episode is Season 7, Episode 6, Phantasms. Data's first bad dream turns into a real-life nightmare for the rest of the Entrepreneur crew. Do you remember this episode, Adam?
Is this the one where Troy is a cake and there's a phone inside Data?
Oh, is it?
God, there's not many episodes left. That would be...
I know. That seems like this would be the one.
That would be the one, I would imagine.
It's like knowing someone's face and knowing someone's name at this point, and I rarely am able to connect those two. If someone's asking me about so-and-so, and I'm like, I think I know who you're talking about. This is what we're talking about with these episodes. It's like, I don't know episode names, but I'm fairly confident that I can describe an episode story. Maybe that's it.
A couple years ago, I met just like randomly at a party a guy who knew all of the episode names, numbers, and seasons.
Oh, God.
And I was like really blown away by that, because that is just not a kind of information that my brain can hold on to.
That is a special kind of knowledge that I just don't have.
Yeah. A little intimidating. I was like, maybe I'm not a Star Trek nerd.
Well, do you want to watch that episode, Ben?
I do. If it's the episode where Troy is a cake, I want to watch it.
It better be the Troy is a cake episode, because I'm into watching it too.
Okay. Well, it sounds like no vetoes will be deployed in this instance.
There are people screaming into their podcast devices right now about this not being the Troy cake episode, I bet.
Guys, that's not how podcasts work. It's kind of a one-way medium. It's not like talking on the phone.
Well, one conventional way that our podcast ends every time is by reading our credits, which include thanking Dark Materia for our theme and interstitial music, as well as Adam Ragusea for all of our great extra music.
We should thank all the beautiful viewers who have gone on Apple Podcasts and left us a nice review, or wherever you leave reviews for podcasts. If you could leave us a nice review, that really helps raise the visibility of our program and helps us find new viewers to embarrass in public.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways to support the show, like those reviews. You can go to MaximumFun.org/donate to help support the ongoing production of the show. You can get a Priority One message there. You can get a t-shirt or a glass.
Yeah, one thing that we're doing with our upcoming tour is we're just going to do the tour t-shirt on the Max Fun store, because we figured that the amount of shirts that we would need to take around would just be like totally impossible for the two of us to schlep. So there will be a merch table with other stuff on the tour, but our tour t-shirt will be available on the Max Fun store. So that will be available to everybody.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
So, go do that. And with that, we will be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, and an episode of The Greatest Generation that we kind of think we remember, but dreamlike, it's kind of slipping away as we try to access it, and it just evaporates in our... into thin air.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.